Welcome to Deception in the Last Days with your host, Randy Shelton. Randy is a member of the Biblical Discernment and Research Center. He has been studying cults and new religious movements for over 30 years. Join Randy as he discerns the deception going on now in the last days.
This is part number 83 in my series, Liberalism, the New Improved Broad Road to Destruction. It's also part four in my little sub-series that I'm doing, which I entitled Powerful Voices from the Past, Warning of an Imminent Future. Now, I left off looking at a Wikipedia article last week, and I found an important piece of literature that I had wanted to comment on in that article. In other words, I found what I needed, folks, and it was a good time for me to end last week's study. So I'm going to go back into this article that I was reading from concerning Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, one of the real originators of the modern New Age movement. And we were looking at his connection to the New Age movement. And so I want to read from this article concerning some more of his beliefs. If you tune in last week's podcast, you can see more from this article that I shared and some of the other aspects besides the New Age movement. Teilhard's cosmic theology is largely predicated on his interpretation of Pauline scripture, particularly Colossians 1:15 through 17 and 1 Corinthians 15:28. He draws on the Christ-centricism of these two Pauline passages to construct a cosmic theology which recognizes the absolute primacy of Christ. Really, I didn't even really need to share that with you because there's nothing really truly biblically Christian about his beliefs. So let me move to what I wanted to share here. He understands creation to be a teleological process towards union with the Godhead. Total blasphemy and heresy, affected through the incarnation and redemption of Christ, in whom all things hold together. He further posits that creation will not be complete until participated being is totally united with God through Christ in the Pleroma, when God will be all in all. And this really moves me to actually look at, and I'm going to go ahead and quote from Samuel Andrews' book, Christianity and Anti-Christianity, which is one of those ancient voices that I mentioned in the subtitle of my talk, Powerful Voices from the Past. We've looked at some of the others, and I want to say a little bit more about his book in a minute, but I'm going to go ahead and quote from it now before I do so, because it just fits the flow better of what I'm doing. Now, again, concerning what Desjardins believed about this process towards union with the Godhead, let's see what Samuel Andrews said in 1898 when he wrote this book. He says, he's talking about a divine humanity in God. He said, before considering, we may be reminded of the Orthodox faith, and that's you and me, folks, if we know Christ and we trust the Bible, is God's revelation to us, that man was created by God in his own image, but is absolutely distinct in his essence from his creator. It was this created nature which the Son took when he came into the world and became man. He came under the law of death, but rose from the dead, and in the risen and glorified form of this nature he now abides. As opposed to this faith, this school of Neo or New Christians affirms that the incarnation as realized in him was not a union of two natures, but the development or determination of the divine in the form of the human. And then further down the page he says, the incarnation is a revelation of the essential humanity of God and of the potential divinity of man. It says, thus there is in the Godhead a human element, and as the Godhead is incapable of change, it must be an eternal element. Moving on to page 152 of his book, he says, we thus reach a new conception of the person of Christ and a new doctrine of the incarnation are really what we might say a seducing spirit bringing a doctrine of devils, of from devils. It says, it was to reveal this humanity and thus to teach men that it has always existed and is divine, that the Son came into the world. And in my notes I wrote, you know, we're evolving. We are, you know, Christ was just the way shower. He was showing us all how we could evolve like him into some sort of cosmic evolution and attain, you know, this deity by realizing through via pantheism, the belief therein, that we're all God and just need to realize it. He goes on, and this revelation was made by the taking of a mortal body, thus bringing his divine humanity under certain limitations. The divine humanity cannot be separated from God and cannot become really evil, and therefore the work of the Son on earth was not to offer himself a sacrifice for the sins of men. We hear that a lot these days, you know, in like in the Shack, of course, or the author of the Shack doesn't believe, as well as the emerging church leaders and many liberals. Anyway, getting back to what I was reading, therefore, the work of the Son on earth was not to offer himself a sacrifice for the sins of men, which is exactly what he did come to do, but to present us with a perfected specimen, the type, the promise, the potency of the entire race of tempted, suffering humanity. The sacrificial aspects of the atonement vanish. Moving on. Thus, the end of the incarnation was not, by the Lord's assumption of our nature and by his death, to condemn sin in the flesh and to bring in through resurrection a new and immortal form of humanity, as has always been taught by the church and from the Bible, but to show men that the eternal divine humanity possessed by the Son is theirs as their birthright, and that to regain it is the perfect life. As said by a certain Bishop Brooks, the work of Christ was to build a bridge on which man might walk fearfully but safely back into the divinity where he belonged. That's sort of sounds like what the serpent promised Eve, that you shall be as gods. And finally, from this book, I want to read page 158. It says, in this outline of the new Christianity, we must keep in mind that in both its forms, it attempts to hold a mediating position between the Orthodox faith, as represented in the great creeds and the strong pantheistic tendencies of our time, and therefore may be presented under varying aspects as one element or the other may predominate in the mind of the writer. Doubtless there are many who are quite unaware how far their theology is pervaded by the pantheistic leaven. This was back in 1898 amongst the liberals. But anyone who reads our more recent theological literature with open eyes will not fail to see that a doctrine of a divine humanity, a humanity eternally existing in God, or of a general incarnation under the name of immanence, is rapidly supplanting the doctrine of a humanity created by God in his image, and now fallen and sinful and alienated from God, and to be redeemed only by the atoning sacrifice of his only begotten Son, the Word made flesh. It is plain that the doctrine of the immanence of God in man, and that a human element in God, each lays a broad basis for the deification of man, and so serves as a preparation for the Antichrist. And, you know, I looked at an article from a theology dictionary, and in it... And, of course, there it is. There we go. It's called Pocket Dictionary of Theological Terms. And he says, concerning immanence, is the idea that God is present in, close to, and involved with creation. Unlike pantheism, which teaches that God and the world are one, or that God is the soul or animating principle of the world, Christian theology teaches that God is constantly involved with creation, without actually becoming exhausted by creation or ceasing to be divine in any way. It says, see also transcendence. So the idea, you know, is that God is immanent and transcendent. But I believe the way Samuel Andrews and the way maybe it was being defined in his time, it appears, is that the idea of immanence of God in man was closer to a pantheistic type notion. And so his concerns were along that line. You know, God is not immanent in man, But, you know, in the idea of being in man, but being present or close to or involved in creation. Okay. Got that out of my system. Now, I wanted to look now and give a little further props, you know, give another endorsement to this wonderful book by Samuel Andrews, and say a few more things about it. I've spoken of it in the past, but I just wanted to mention that this book, in the preface of the book of 1898, he said some things like, to the thoughtful mind, the outlook at the close of the 19th century is profoundly interesting. History can furnish no parallel to it. He mentions about what is its significance? Why a new age? He was talking about a new age then in a different kind of a way, but somewhat similar, I suppose. Are our old beliefs, our old institutions outgrown? Are we about to break with the past and take a sudden leap forward or onward? It says, when the new age has finally developed itself, what religion will it give us? Will it be some new phase of Christianity or an eclectic religion or something distinctly new? And then that was the preface. In the commendation of the book and an appeal by James Gray, who was at the time the president of the Moody Bible Institute, he said, after the Bible, a concordance, and a Bible dictionary, he said that the next book I would recommend was this book, Christianity and Anti-Christianity and Their Final Conflict, by Reverend Samuel Andrews. He says, in this work, he is dealing soberly and scientifically with the first of the teachings of the Old and New Testament respecting the Antichrist, and dealing soberly and scientifically with the conflict in which we are now engaged. Treating first of the teachings of the Old and New Testaments respecting the Antichrist and the falling away of the church, and then the tendencies which are preparing the way for the final climax of the age. These tendencies, including modern philosophy, biblical criticism, science, literature, and Christian socialism, leading up to the deification of humanity. How interesting. And he goes on, the book concludes with a foreview of the actual reign of the Antichrist on earth as the head of the nations, and a study of the church of that period and the morality that shall prevail. And you know, the tendencies he saw in 1898, how much more are we seeing them now in our days? I believe that's it's pretty evident to he who has an eye to see and an ear to hear. Now, the table of contents also just shows you how impressive this book was in the inspiration that, you know, well, how God used this book, I believe, to warn people then and even now. In part three of the table of contents, some of the subheadings, tendencies in our day preparing the way of the Antichrist, modern pantheistic philosophy, modern philosophy and the new Christianity, deification of humanity, and then under the reign of the Antichrist, again, there's mention of the pantheistic revolution. So, very impressive book that I recommend strongly. It's been out of print, but I'll get to that in a minute, that it is actually in print now, which is exciting to me. Let's look at some what others have said about this book. A man by the name of A.J. Conyers, in a book called The End, I guess somewhat appropriate, on page 90, he says, it is the pantheism of our age, not necessarily the so-called Eastern pantheism, but the decidedly practical Western pantheism that presents us with this new prospect of human deification. And then he says, a book written in 1898 will help us to see how seriously one might draw the connection between pantheistic philosophies or the deification of humanity in modern times and the real threat of historical consequences. When Samuel Andrews wrote Christianity and Anti-Christianity in 1898, no one could have known how accurate were his misgivings about where the world was going. He wrote well before World War I, the rise of Bolshevism, Nazism, the Holocaust of World War II, and the continuing trends of ideologies into our present time. By the end of the 19th century, many had already observed a rising tide of mass movements that would earlier have been confined to fringed groups and depended by and large on a new concept of humanity's place in the world. But only now can we see how accurately some tied the pantheistic thinking of these movements to tragic historical consequences. Andrews traced the progress of pantheism in modern times, and he pointed to W.F. Hegel as the most powerful representative of that thought. Quoting John Stuart Mill, Andrews noted, "The philosophical writings of Schelling and Hegel have given pantheistic principles a complacent admission and a currency which they never before this age possessed in any part of Christendom." Already in 1857, James Buchanan had said, "The grand ultimate struggle between Christianity and atheism will resolve itself into a controversy between Christianity and pantheism." Then Andrews concluded in his late 19th century book, "A mighty wave of pantheism beginning in Germany has been sweeping over Christendom during the present century and now finds but little to resist it. It will give us a new religion based upon a new conception of God, a new Christianity based upon a new conception of Christ, a universe evolved, not created. It is a religion which many will gladly welcome, for it opens a wide gate and a broad way in which all men, or whatever belief, may walk without jostling one another." And now, another, what somebody else was saying about the book, and a newsletter, News from Israel, the article, the title was Babylon, Europe, and the World. And this is Arno Frosch, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, but on page 13 of this newsletter, it says, "A voice from the 19th century." In the 19th century, Samuel Andrews wrote the following under the heading, "The Pantheistic Revolution. The multitude is made familiar with its principles through magazines and newspapers, through lectures in the pulpit. Its prevalence is shown in the rapidity with which such systems as those of Christian Science, Mental Science, Theosophy, and others kindred to them have spread in Christian communities, for all have an atheistic basis. The moral atmosphere is full of its spirit, and many are affected by it unawares. What shall we say of its diffusion eventually? To judge of this, we must look upon its spread from another point of view and consider its affinity with democracy." That was from page 254. Even before communism and Nazism became a visible reality, Samuel Andrews recognized the beginning of Mystery Babylon. He continues, "It is not to be questioned that social and political conditions have much influence in molding religious opinions, and we assume that the democratic spirit will rule the future. What type of religious influence is democracy adapted to exert? In what direction does the democratic current run? According to de Tocqueville, it runs in the direction of very general ideas and therefore to pantheism. The idea of the unity of the people as a whole, as one, preponderates, and this extends itself to the world and to the universe. God and the universe make one whole. This unity has charms for men living in democracies and prepares them for pantheistic beliefs." He goes on, the author of this, Arnold, says, "Today, there's little denying that the world is becoming one, although before 1898, when Andrews wrote this, there was no visible proof of such a coming world unity." Notice that he also pointed out the element of deception. "Among the different systems by whose aid philosophy tries to explain the universe, I believe pantheism to be one of those most fitted to seduce the human mind in democratic ages, and against it all who abide in their attachment to the great, to the true greatness of man should struggle and combine." If these remarks of this very acute political observer are true, he's quoting another man there, "we may expect to see pantheism enlarging its influence in Christendom as democracy extends." Now, I had an interesting experience many years ago, and actually it was in around 1999. And I had gone to a conference in the Dallas area, actually South Lake, Texas. And it was a group of Christian men, including Dave Hunt, who were there. And the title of this article is "Signers of Evangelical Catholic Accords Publicly Urged to Repent." Deciding no longer to seek redress on this very grievous matter through private means, organizers of a conference critical of the controversial Evangelicals and Catholics Together documents took their protest a step further by issuing a public call to repentance to some 20 evangelical ECT signers. This took place at Countryside Bible Church in Southlake, Texas, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And I only mention that because when I was there at that conference, of course, where Dave Hunt was also there speaking, I saw Dave and I mentioned to him, I said, hey, you know, are you familiar with a book? And of course, it was that book, which I had actually had in my possession, Christianity and Anti-Christianity. I found that at a local library sale about 20 years ago. And so I had it for some time at the time. And I mentioned it to Dave, and I said, because I thought of Dave and his writings and his book or books concerning Bible prophecy, etc. And I mentioned the book to him. And he had actually he had said that he thought he had heard of it. He thought he was familiar with it, but I don't think he actually read it based on what I'm about to tell you in a minute. Anyway, I might as well mention a little bit more about that conference since I brought it up. It says, we do this. We felt compelled to do this by our love for these men and love for the truth. And that was Tom McMahon, Dave Hunt's co-writer and the present head of Berean Call Ministries that Dave Hunt started. He says, we do this in simple obedience to the scriptures. And of course, again, he's talking about the Evangelical and Catholics Together movement. He says, the organizers of the conference, for the most part, we do this in simple obedience to the scriptures. We look to the example of Paul, who opposed Peter in Galatians 2. The organizers of the conference, for the most part, directors of evangelical ministries dedicated to evangelizing Roman Catholics, view ECT as hurting to their cause. So anyway, talks about Dave Hunt. He was a national television program host, and Southern Baptist Church member John Ankerberg were also two of the conference's principal speakers. So I wanted to mention that was a very important conference, and I was thankful that I got to go. But it was interesting to me because I mentioned the book to Dave, thinking, oh, he would love that book. I mean, it would just, you know, knock him out if he got a hold of it. And what happened was that most recently, Tom McMahon in the Berean Call newsletter in August of 2017, this is what he says concerning these things. He said that in my privileged years of working with Dave Hunt, he addressed as few others the increasing apostasy that was seducing Christianity. I then began to realize that the things he was pointing out were moving in a direction that would culminate in a condition unparalleled in human history. As I reaffirmed in the June 2017 Berean Call newsletter, the assorted false religious beliefs, dogmas, practices, although appearing to differ greatly from one another, have always been rooted together and headed toward the same end. My attitude regarding the significance of the Antichrist and his religion changed with the realization of something that should have been obvious to me. All that entails the Antichrist deception of the world and the seduction of Christianity does not wait until after the rapture of the church for their efforts to be realized. He goes on, obviously the rapture has yet to take place. The apostasy, however, and its impact upon Christendom is without a doubt growing exponentially. He goes on to say, although I have been addressing at times over the past few years specific aspects of the coming world religions, it's a great encouragement to have those whom I respect in the Lord confirm my writings on the subject. One of those friends told me to read a book that he believed would be of further encouragement. I got it and read it. To use one of Dave Hunt's favorite expressions, wow. That would have been his response without a doubt. The book is what I would call a pre-confirmation, meaning it confirms what we've been describing regarding the apostasy. With this amazing distinction, it was written in 1898. Its title is Christianity and Anti-Christianity and Their Final Conflict. In this and next month's article, I hope to present some of the author's observations and biblical evaluations, just as I've been doing in my podcast, which are rather extensive and primarily cover the years during the late 1800s. Yet the issues addressed read as if they were happening today because they are all part of the adversary's scheme to establish the religion of the Antichrist and his kingdom. The author, Samuel Andrews, claims no special prophetic insight. He simply does what he exhorts all Christians to do, and that is search the scriptures for its prophetic information and discern the things that are taking place in our own day. He continues, to ignore the Antichrist of whom the church has been forewarned is for the church to expose herself defenseless to his wiles, deceptions, and attacks. It says, it's only through scriptural light that we can fully know the character and work of the Antichrist, and to this light it is of vital importance that we give heed. It need not be said that this man and his kingdom, the Antichrist, are not the accidents of an hour. There is a long preparatory process. As with our Lord, so with him there is a fullness of time for his appearing, and this is not till the anti-Christian leaven has spread throughout or through Christendom. Although Andrews identifies much of what that leaven entails, he underscores the sickly spiritual condition of the church that initially allowed that leaven. And Andrews lists here a few glaring issues that he addresses. The increasing antagonism of the world toward biblical Christianity, the apostasy as it grows exponentially, the growing belief that worldwide revival is coming, the idea that a new age is dawning with pantheism being the chief doctrine, the teaching that God is all and is in all, the hope that science will ultimately reveal all knowledge, the belief that evolution is how the world came about, the concept that mankind is evolving into godhood, the argument that these false beliefs will glorify humanity. The author's approach is discerning his times was quite simple and unique, yet foundationally biblical. Now, I want to move on. It says, our hope is to reprint this book. Now, in the next article, in the next newsletter, part two, Anti-Christianity Ascending, I'll just have time to read a bit of it, I think. Andrews realized that if there is a departure from the faith, it will have serious consequences that will escalate to an awful conclusion, resulting in devastating spiritual wreckage. He found this stated in no uncertain terms in the book of Revelation, talking about the church of Ephesus losing their first love. There's a lot more I'd like to read. The following brief summary of just some of his insights leaves one in awe of his biblical and historical discernment. I think I'm going to do this justice, I think I'm going to read a little bit more of this in the next podcast before I go into my next topic, because I don't want to rush this, and I am running out of time. So God bless you all. Keep looking up. Jesus is coming soon.